from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the realities of California's fiscal crisis are starting to sink in as Governor Jerry Brown's Democratic allies speak out against his budget.
That is the hardest thing to pull off, to stop the bleeding, the death by a thousand cuts that can happen when all the interest groups start hacking away at a budget.
And as baby boomers start turning 65, Medicare braces for the demographic tsunami and a shortage of primary care doctors.
As a medical student, I had a couple physicians who said, oh, family medicine? Why would you go into family medicine? You get paid peanuts and there's no prestige in it.
Those stories, plus Central American immigrants in Los Angeles put their personal stories into writing, inspiring high school students to do the same. It's the California Report. You know, there's an old saying that if you want a friend in politics, get a dog. Maybe that's why Jerry Brown is thinking of adopting Sutter, a corgi that belongs to his sister. After all, just about everyone seems to hate the governor's solution to the state's $25 billion budget deficit. And as Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers explains, it's only going to get tougher from here.
Jerry Brown is nothing if not unpredictable. As anger grew this week over his budget plan to stop using property tax dollars for redevelopment projects, the governor could have skipped Wednesday's luncheon of unhappy officials from cities around the state.
Everybody eating already? Because you look a little hungry to me.
And once there, he could have avoided drawing attention to his support for redevelopment projects when he was mayor of Oakland. But Brown didn't miss a beat on that one either.
I built a lot of good things. I liked redevelopment. I didn't quite understand it. Seemed kind of magical. You know, I put a lot into the Fox Theater. Got this beautiful theater. Tens of millions of dollars. I don't know that I would have got it any other way. So I'm sure glad I got it built before this damn budget came out.
Jerry Brown's first 3 weeks in his return as governor have been full of just these kinds of unconventional moves. They seem to give credence to his often stated pledge that he didn't seek the job to engage in either delay or denial about what's led California to its current crisis. But some see his path forward as taking steps backwards. Take the redevelopment proposal, which would send billions of local property tax dollars in years to come towards government services and away from development projects.
Abolishing the most important jobs program in the state of California, we're going to fight that and fight it with everything we have.
Chris McKenzie is executive director of the League of California Cities. He says Brown's plan to stop funding local redevelopment is illegal under a measure voters approved just 2 months ago.
Last November, 5.7 million voters in California with a 61-39% vote margin said the state should absolutely, unconditionally stop taking local funds to balance the state budget.
That's far from the only budget fight Jerry Brown has on his hands. His plan for deep cuts and steep taxes has drawn much of the predictable fire for being too harsh or too extravagant. And there will be significant budget proposals unrelated to his plan that the legislature will seek to add. Already, members of both the Assembly and Senate have introduced bills that either seek to add additional tax credits, which cost money, or add tax laws, which would bring in money. Count in that last category another attempt to force online shopping sites like Amazon.com to collect sales tax.
I think that the dialogue has shifted, and it's not just about revenue to us.
Assemblymember Nancy Skinner is a Democrat from Berkeley who has tried to make the change before.
When we initially introduced the bill, there were a lot of retailers who, not sure. Now it's across the board, retailers up and down our state, large and small.
But there's also the unmistakable change at the top. The former Republican governor vetoed the idea in 2009. Soon, Governor Brown may be asked to weigh in. The online sales tax proposal is by no means the most controversial idea out there, but it does symbolize the start of the legislative process, where Jerry Brown will have to navigate budget fights not of his own choosing. And that gets all the more complicated if the governor's own proposal languishes.
You know, the longer a plan sits out there, the longer it can get ripped apart. So it's in his interest to use this honeymoon period to get it done.
Democratic strategist Steve Maviglio has worked for both a governor and a speaker of the assembly. He says Governor Brown has succeeded in crafting a plan that's not easily pigeonholed as too liberal or too conservative. But now comes the hard part, getting consensus on a budget plan in time for Brown to ask voters to ratify parts of that plan at a special election this June.
That is the hardest thing to pull off, to stop the bleeding, the death by a thousand cuts that can happen when all the interest groups start hacking away at a budget.
That's the $25 billion question facing Jerry Brown. Can he find consensus and quickly? Perhaps the best thing going for him, recent polls showing that after all of the state's crises, the public doesn't have high hopes of success anytime soon. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
The first baby boomers began turning 65 this month, and just as that huge generation starts needing more health care, their ability to find a doctor is getting tougher. That's because many primary care doctors are themselves boomers getting ready to retire. Trouble is, there are too few younger doctors to replace them, and low Medicare reimbursement rates aren't helping any. April Domboski reports on the shortage of primary care doctors.
This is Building 80 at San Francisco General Hospital. The waiting room on the fifth floor is packed.
This is one of our dysfunctional primary care clinics.
That's attending physician Tom Bodenheimer.
And it's got two floors, the first floor and the fifth floor, and they are linked by an elevator that may or may not work. And you can't use the stairs. I mean, it's just the architecture is not well suited to team-based care at all.
It's bad news for patients, but the impression left on medical students rotating through is even worse.
They see the lack of continuity of care, and they don't like it.
It's just one experience steering medical students away from careers in primary care. Coming out of med school $100,000 or $200,000 in debt, more and more graduates are choosing to become specialists. Fields like dermatology, radiology, or orthopedics offer more manageable schedules and pay twice or even three times as much as primary care.
As a medical student, I had a couple physicians who said, oh, family medicine? Why would you go into family medicine? You get paid peanuts and there's no prestige in it.
Brian Lang is a third-year primary care resident at SF General.
As a med student, you have to actively seek out mentors to find someone who will encourage you to go into primary care.
60.
Part of the Affordable Care Act is designed to strengthen loan forgiveness programs to ease financial pressure off students who choose primary care. Still, researchers expect there to be a shortfall of 44,000 primary care doctors in the U.S. by 2020. California will be short at least 10,000 doctors by 2020. And by then, half of all baby boomers will be 65 and eligible for Medicare. Finding a primary care doctor could be extremely challenging. Ed O'Neill is the director of the Center for the Health Professions at UC San Francisco. He says geriatricians will be even harder to come by.
Geriatrics oftentimes makes their patients comfortable, but they're not cured from the host of presenting problems and complaints that they have, and that lack of being able to cure or fix or correct probably has played against the interest for physicians to go into geriatrics.
Medical schools are responding by attempting to train all doctors, nurses, and pharmacists in geriatrics, but even that won't solve the problem. O'Neill says Medicare needs to lead the charge by revamping the way it pays doctors. Right now, the fee-for-service system only pays primary care doctors for every 15-minute in-person visit.
That 15-minute visit is really from another century. It's very inefficient. It's not very consumer-oriented.
O'Neill says the current reimbursement system doesn't allow for the use of the many technologies that save patients and doctors time. Doctors can't get paid for using telemedicine systems to consult with patients in rural clinics or at home. And they can't get paid for emails.
It'd be a little bit like saying, gee, I really value that relationship with the teller. I'm not going to go to a bank that has an ATM because I like waiting in line for that interpersonal connection with my teller.
In addition to trying to increase physician supply, researchers are experimenting with new ways of delivering services that take doctors out of the equation altogether.
To begin to incentivize seniors, Medicare enrollees, to move to new alternatives like group visits, home visits, using the internet to manage part of their chronic disease burden.
I don't think doctors are the end-all or be-all of the health system.
That's 80-year-old Lorilla Harris. She says she's been pretty unhappy with Medicare.
It's not a health plan. It's an unhealthy plan. Everywhere I turn, there's a brick wall.
Okay, so everyone has their name tags on.
She's so frustrated with long waits to see a doctor, she's trying an alternative at the Curry Senior Center in San Francisco.
So we're going to go over action plans and other fun things to help you empower yourselves and your health.
This is the first meeting of a six-week healthier living workshop where people learn how to better manage chronic conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and arthritis. There's no doctor here, no nurse. Just health educator Akila Kade and about 10 other seniors who have come to learn from each other.
Who would like to go next?
Yes, we all cut down on sweets. How much? Completely. When? Every day at meal times.
Good. That's a good plan.
The federal government is investing millions to start similar workshops around the country. The hope is that if boomers can manage their own diseases, they won't need to go to the doctor as often. And the shortage of primary care physicians won't seem so bad. For the California Report, I'm April Demboski.
Of course, getting old isn't what it used to be. The coming generation of seniors is working long past traditional retirement age. They're also keeping in much better shape than their parents did. In San Francisco, one dance teacher has invented a new workout called Boomer Size to make fitness a little easier. Reporter Deirdre Kennedy sent us this audio postcard.
At a dance studio near the Golden Gate Bridge, teacher Marcy Juddelson leads an enthusiastic group of women through a series of familiar steps.
Jump back.
This low-impact boomer-sized class is based on popular dances from the 50s and 60s, like the Madison, the Swim, the Jerk, and many more. Juddelson came up with the routine about 4 years ago, out of frustration with the typical aerobic classes designed for 20-somethings.
I always loved to dance, and as I got older, I realized I needed to exercise more, but I just couldn't find an aerobics class that was right for me, because I don't like the music at most aerobics classes, and also one that was just more dance-oriented than exercise.
You all know how to do the twist, okay? Give me your best twist.
Juddelson plays the biggest hits from the mid-20th century by the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Beach Boys, songs that came out when these dancers were in junior high and high school.
They do bring back memories of sock hops in the 50s. A sock hop was a dance held in the gym. You danced in your socks and you decorated your socks.
We used to do the twist, the pony, the Watusi. These are all old American bandstand dances.
I also love when a new song comes on that I haven't heard in 20 years, and I know every word, and I'm in that back row singing and dancing. It's great.
Here we go. Pony. You know the pony. It was easier when we were 10 years old, but we still
The boomer sizers show plenty of attitude, wiggling their hips, shaking their fingers and miming the words, just like their teenage idols did on TV. Juddelson says as a girl, she and her friends learned every new dance as soon as it came out.
I mean, it seemed like in those days these dances would just appear. In some cases, it originated with a popular song. There would be a theme song about a dance, like the locomotion, or obviously, you know, the swim or the twist, certainly. And I don't know if the dance came from the song or vice versa in every case. There was just a regular supply of new dances.
And unlike back in the day, at this dance, there's no peer pressure to look good or be the coolest. Boomer Pat Pennington says no one really cares if they get the steps just right.
Every once in a while she throws in a few new ones, which makes it interesting. I still can't master the mambo, and I can do the feet, but I can't do the hands with the feet, so I'm working on that now. I just have fun.
After class, I thought about what my friends will be exercising to when they're seniors. I guess someone will have to come up with Gothercise. For the California Report, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
You'll find lots more information about baby boomers and Medicare from our show Health Dialogues. It's on the web at healthdialogues.org. Any short list of top writers from Latin America would include the names of prominent authors from Mexico, Colombia, Chile, and Argentina. People like Carlos Fuentes, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Pablo Neruda. Well, now in Los Angeles, where many refugees from El Salvador settled after a bloody civil war 3 decades ago, Salvadoran American writers are beginning to add their voices, too. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez talked to one of them as he took his story to a public school classroom.
A small publisher accepted 38-year-old Randy Jurado Ertel's nonfiction memoir, Hope in Times of Darkness, a Salvadoran-American experience. On his self-financed book tour, the authors visited more community centers than Barnes & Nobles. On this day, he's reading from his book to a group of students at an East Hollywood middle school about how he left El Salvador at the beginning of its civil war in 1980 and arrived as South L.A. was embroiled in a gang war.
So escaping a civil war and landing in another one is not what a 5-year-old child expects. Yet again, nothing in life is easy, especially while being deported to El Salvador as an 8-month-old baby with my mother. Immigration agents arrested my mother while she worked at a sweatshop in downtown Los Angeles.
Ertel graduated from Occidental College in Los Angeles and worked for former Congresswoman Hilda Solis. Now he heads a Pasadena-based social service agency. He tells students that his story is worth reading because 30 years later, life's still a minefield for Central Americans in this neighborhood.
What I wrote is real. And it took a lot of courage to do it, really, to talk about my own life and to expose myself in a way to the world, you know. But I felt it was important to share my life with students like yourselves.
His memoir details how he and his mother barely escaped a fatal attack on protesters in a plaza in El Salvador, how they learned firsthand about drive-by shootings after they moved into a home in South L.A., and how abusive teachers were insensitive to the needs of refugee children like him. He wrote about the dark chapters in his life, he says, to emphasize how educational opportunities opened doors for him. Ertel liberally sprinkled his memoir with commentary about social injustice and Central American pride.
There really isn't any literature that our students can identify with that is a nonfiction narrative. There are fiction novels, there's some poetry, but there really isn't much for the new generation of Salvadoran Americans who've been born here or raised here in the United States.
The fork in the road that took Ertel away from a tough neighborhood and to college came when he was 15. That's when he convinced his parents to let him enroll in a college preparatory high school halfway across the country through a national program called A Better Chance. Many of the kids of Central America's Civil War refugees are doing well for themselves, Ertel says, but many others, especially in this hardscrabble, working-class neighborhood, are not. Scratch the surface here at LeConte Middle School and you'll hear their stories.
My mom's from Salvador, my dad's from Guatemala, and they've been here for like at least 20 years.
Wooden rosary beads dangle over 8th grader Hector Pinto's white undershirt as he talks about a turning point in his life 3 years earlier.
During 5th grade, I was so alone that I decided to want to be one of those kids that joined in the gang because I want to be one of those kids that get respect because everyone used to bully me. Like almost the whole school didn't like me. And I was like right there all alone every time eating.
Sports turned him around, he says, and now he's enrolled in honors classes. Classmate Angela Ramirez's parents migrated from El Salvador to escape the Civil War. She was born and raised in L.A.
I struggled when I was a little kid because I had really, my dad was really violent to my mom. And he was in jail for a while, then my mom went back with him, but we still have the same problems, but he's getting normal.
Bertel's writing is important, says Kansas University literature professor Yahaira Padilla, an expert on U.S. Latino and Central American literature.
Because it is something that talks very frank and openly about his experiences growing up in the inner city, and especially as a Salvadoran American. And related to that, the fact that he places that label on it as Salvadoran American.
Padilla says Americans of Central American descent are mining their immigrant experience in memoirs, novels, and poetry.
How they stand in contrast, how they build an ethnic identity alongside or in dialogue or in contrast with not only like Anglo-Americans, African-Americans, but other more predominant Latino groups like Mexican-Americans, Puerto Rican-Americans, or even Cuban-Americans.
New books by these authors are adding new chapters to the already rich canon of American literature written by immigrants and their children. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
So, do you have a favorite song about California?
Come on, let's go to where it's fun. I want a slice of L.A. sun. Whoa-ho-ho. Whoa-ho-ho. Honey, let's go. Feels like never had to come.
That's a song called Ode to L.A. by the Raveonettes, a Danish pop band, and it's just one of the songs that we're going to include in a music stream we're doing in collaboration with NPR. It's called Beyond California Dream, and it goes live on Monday, and you can find it at nprmusic.org and californiareport.org. California Report director Susie Rocho chooses the music you hear on this show, and she compiled this list of songs as well, and Susie Rocho joins me now. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Scott.
Well, tell us about this list. It's 80-plus songs. How did you decide what to include?
Basically, what we did was we asked our listeners to send in their suggestions, and so they did via email, on Facebook, and then we asked the staff here in the building, in the station, and so that's how the list was compiled. And then there were a few things that I just went into iTunes and Wikipedia and other places and just dug and found some things that were under the radar.
Now, there are some that obviously leap to mind. Hotel California, the Eagles, California Dreamin', of course, Mamas and the Papas, but this is not a greatest hits list.
You know, I kind of wanted to not have a greatest hits. I mean, those songs are great, and they resonate with a lot of people, especially songs like California Girls, California Dreamin', Hotel California. But you can hear those anywhere. You know, you can hear them on the radio. And what I was trying to do with this is also mix up the genres. You know, it's not just, you know, classic rock that owns the genre. You know, there are a lot of songs on here that were like album cuts. You know, they weren't singles. You know, you might not have heard them on the radio.
So, now, you're a music person. You pick the music that we hear on the California Report. But were there a lot of songs that you hadn't heard of or versions of songs you thought, wow, you know, I didn't know this person did that song?
Well, there were definitely some nuggets that I hadn't heard before that came through emails, people's suggestions. And one of them was a song called California Soul, which is a Ashford and Simpson song. It seems like they've got their hands into a lot of songs. But it's a great song. It was recorded in 1969 by Marlena Shaw, and it first appeared a couple of years before that as a song put out by the Fifth Dimension.
Like a sound you hear that lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere, no matter what you do.
Yeah. looking down the list of songs by title, of course, the most frequent word is California, as you would expect. But were there themes about California that kept popping up, either that are on this list or ones that you know folks sent you through the email?
It really seemed to be divided between this is home, I love California, it's so beautiful. There's songs about the landscape and the sun and the weather. And then the other side of it completely, which is just, you know, my dreams have been broken. I didn't get famous. This, you know, L.A. just
couldn't
chews you up.
Couldn't afford to live here.
Yeah, exactly. Just the myth didn't live up to the reality. And so there are definitely songs about, you know, leaving California kind of broken, you know, so there's definitely the dark side also.
You would also expect a lot of songs about San Francisco, Los Angeles, but what about other parts of the state?
There's definitely songs about the Central Valley. There's, of course, Streets of Bakersfield, which was made famous by Buck Owens. There's also a song called Bakersfield Bound, which is by one of the ex-members of the Byrds, Chris Hillman, which is a great song. Dave Alvin does a song about Highway 99. And, of course, there's Kern River by Merle Haggard.
Any favorite songs that really pop out for you? Ones, you know, ones especially that you hadn't heard of?
Well, you know, one song which I've heard a lot, but I never had heard this version before, was Ray Charles's version of California, Here I Come.
California, here I come, right back where I started from, where bowers of flowers bloom in the sun. Each morning at dawn and bird is singing, everything a sun-kissed miss said, don't be late, that's why I can't hardly wait. So open up your golden gates, California, here I come.
Well, it's a fun list, and I think we can safely say that if you go listen to these songs, you're going to hear some music you haven't heard before.
That's absolutely true.
That's Susie Racho. She put together the stream of music called Beyond California Dreamin'. You can hear it starting Monday. Just head on over to californiareport.org, where you'll also find our entire California Songs series. Again, that's californiareport.org. Susie, thanks for pulling it together.
Thanks, Scott.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Nina Thorson. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Paul Lancourt. Our interns are Lillian Mongeau and Alexandra Wexler. The producer is Victoria Maleone. Our senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. Polly Stryker was a contributing editor this week. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.